The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
My topic tonight is the Buddha's response to despair. And this is a 4th of July reflection. Many of us have been profoundly disturbed by recent political events, particularly the psychologically and physically violent separation of children from their asylum-seeking parents on the U.S. border. And since today is July 4th, our national holiday celebrating the Declaration of Independence, the proclamation of the self-evident truths of equality, and the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it seems to me it's an appropriate day to reflect on how we live our practice of non-harming, our practice of seeing things clearly in today's America. Last week, I was reminded of the Buddha's response to trauma and despair by the Zen teacher Ben Conley. And he spoke of Patakara, whose story is one of the most wrenching of all the biographies of the early Buddhist nuns. But before I tell that story, and Ben's retelling wasn't the first time I'd heard that story, but I remembered it, and it is a really distressing story. Before I tell Patakara's story, I want to make a few caveats. First, this is an account of extreme trauma, so it may be triggering for some people. So that's just a warning about that. And second, although this story resolves with the development of great wisdom and compassion and leadership, this is not to suggest that every cloud has a silver lining or that grievous injury can always be repaired or transformed. We have plenty of evidence of profound damage that has not been able to be undone. So this is the story. Patakara was a young woman living at the time of the Buddha. She was born into a wealthy family. Today her father would be categorized as a banker. And she had a wonderful childhood. And when she came of age, her parents arranged for her to marry a man of suitable rank. But Patakara loved one of the male servants, and so they ran off together and set up a home some distance away from her parents across the river. At that time, the custom in the northern Gangetic Plain was for a pregnant woman to return home to the home of her mother to have her mother's support and guidance during labor and delivery. So when Patakara became pregnant, she wanted to return to her birth home to have the child. And this, of course, suggests that Patakara believed that her parents still loved her and would welcome her and her child. It suggests that she had been really well loved. Patakara's husband was opposed, since it was not so clear to him that he would be welcome. When Patakara began to feel her labor pains during the night, she crept out of her home and headed toward her parents' residence. When her husband woke up the next morning and found she was gone, he set off after her. He found her by the side of the road, about to give birth. He helped deliver the baby safely, and they returned home. When Patakara became pregnant a second time, she again wanted to be with her mother. And again, her husband was against it. When Padakara felt her time was near, she slipped out at night, taking the toddler, and again her husband pursued her. When he found her and the child, a terrible storm was about to break. Padakara and her little child huddled at the base of a tree while her husband went off to gather branches to shelter them. While he was looking for coverage, he was bitten by a venomous snake and died within minutes. Padakara sheltered her child from the storm with her body during that long night, and in the morning she gave birth to her second child. She feared her husband had abandoned her. She was paralyzed with grief when she discovered his lifeless body. For a day and a night, she remained unmoving with the two children. Destitute and bereft, Padakara decided to make her way to her parents' home. The river that could usually be crossed with moderate effort was now running full and swift due to the storm. Padakara could not carry both children across at the same time. So she had the toddler stay on the shore while she carried the infant to the far shore. She placed the newborn on a bed of leaves and started back. Halfway across the river, she turned and saw a huge bird of prey swoop down and snatch the baby. She started screaming. Alarmed and thinking his mother was calling him, the toddler ran into the river and drowned as he was swept away. Padakara staggered to her parents' home, only to find that the terrible storm had collapsed her parents' residence, killing them. The bodies of her father, her mother, and her brother were burning on funeral pyres when she arrived. Padakara was overcome with despair. She walked around in circles. She became like an animal living at the edge of the forest. She was unclothed, unbathed, eating whatever she could scavenge. Townspeople threw sticks and garbage at her because she seemed to be mad and because she seemed to be bad luck. One day, when Padakara was pacing circles near Jetta's Grove, that was the place that the Buddha was staying, and some of her associates, on seeing her, wanted to drive her off. But instead, the Buddha approached her and put himself directly in her path. When she stopped and looked at him, the Buddha saw her for who she was and with great compassion said, "Sister, please recover your state of mind." Being seen in this way, Padakara could see herself. She came to her senses, was given a cloak, and told the Buddha her story. She asked for his help. And this, for me, is the really interesting insight into the Buddha's compassion. The Buddha tells Padakara he can't help her. He says, "Padakara, don't think that you have come to someone who can help you. In your many lives, you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the ocean." So the Buddha did not deny the reality of Padakara's intense suffering. He did not deny the reality of her suffering. He humanized it. He said, "This is the human condition, the first noble truth." And Padakara found comfort in understanding that she was not alone in her grief. she was not alone in having terrible things happen to her. She was not alone in tragedy. Then the Buddha offered Padakara a way to work with her suffering so that it did not lead to despair. This is the Eightfold Path, cultivating wisdom, living harmoniously, developing a non-distracted mind. So let's look more closely at the Buddha's expression of compassion. Compassion is understood to be the felt recognition of another's suffering with the wholesome desire to alleviate that suffering. In Pali, the language used at the time of the Buddha and used for the early Buddhist strictures, karuna, the word for compassion, is understood as the quivering of the heart in response to another's pain. So, first of all, the Buddha sees Padakara for who she is, and he accepts her for who she is. This is the beginning of compassion. Seeing the person suffering exactly for who that person is, and accepting her. He accepts her when she is foul-smelling, naked, behaving erratically. And he invites her to reclaim her human dignity. And she does. The Buddha listens to Padakara's account of her anguish, and then he tells her the truth. What happened can't be changed. The human condition is one of suffering. We are not in control of nature. Experience is impersonal. Everything that arises passes away. But we can learn to live with these characteristics of existence in a way that supports human dignity and harmonious living. So last fall, my husband and I watched Ken Burns' 10-part Vietnam documentary. We were both in college during the Vietnam War, and I spent a significant part of my freshman year volunteering in Eugene McCarthy's office and for his presidential campaign. And actually, I spent part of my sophomore year having to show the National Guard my student identity to get on campus. So these were experiences that were really close to our own heart, our hearts. And most evenings, we were in tears by the end of each program. So many lives destroyed, fueled by individual and state-supported greed, hatred, and delusion. But I also realized that I've lived through terrible times before, as I think I am living through terrible times now. I've lived through times when the government and our leaders lied to themselves, to the citizens, and protected themselves at the expense of others, and promoted myths of racial, political, and religious inferiority. This is partly what went on during the Vietnam War, and this is partly what is going on now. So in a peculiar way, sort of like Padakara, this comforts me because I know I've lived through it. And I know that it was uprooted by something better. So instead of despair, we can cultivate resolve. Resolve and compassion. The Zen teacher Lou Richmond endured months of a coma and months of rehabilitation after an episode of encephalitis. After his recovery, he recast the three characteristics of existence, what we usually talk about as suffering and impermanence, or sometimes non-self, which to me is more usefully expressed as the impersonality of experience. But he recast it as nothing lasts, everything is connected, you are not alone. Nothing lasts, everything is connected, you are not alone. One very good response to despair. So our compassionate response in these awful times to terrible reactions must be to tell the truth about how things are without succumbing to despair and walking in circles like Patakara, and to do whatever we can to eliminate greed, hatred, and delusion. We begin with ourselves, and then we work with our community, and eventually we work with our state. And it's been really useful, and I've been very glad to see that on Facebook there have been constant reminders that this is not the first time in this country that children have been separated from their parents. And you can think of the many, many, many decades when enslaved mothers and fathers were separated from their children with the approval of the government, with the sanction of the state, with the sanction of religion. And we can think about the terrible separation of Native children, forced separation of Native children from their parents to attend the boarding school. Again, sanctioned by the state, sanctioned by custom, sanctioned by religion. So it's really important to see how our history is in some ways repeating itself, and to see the importance of bearing witness, and again and again, and however we can, however it seems skillful to act. One of the more interesting little images popping up on Facebook this morning is a pastor in Indiana has taken the figures, Mary, Joseph, and the infant, from the Christmas creche and put them on the lawn in front of his church and put them in a cage, put a fence around them the way the asylees are being put in fenced enclosures. Again, a very, very clear and responsive act to put this in context. I used to see a bumper sticker that said, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." And I always wanted to make another bumper that said, "If you're paying attention, you know that outrage is an analgesic, not a cure." That would be a very wordy bumper sticker. But what we know is that while outrage has an immediate sort of flare, it's something that can't be sustained, and it's something that often distracts us from really seeing where we can skillfully act to make changes and to be effective. The folks at UW-Madison who do all the brain scans on the meditators have, I think, some really heartening news. When they study people who have a really strong compassion practice in the fMRI and do the blood tests and all of that, when they see physiologically what happens to a human being who is experiencing deep compassion. And remember, compassion is this sort of felt recognition of another's suffering and this kind of wholesome desire to alleviate it. Their brains secrete oxytocin, and that is the hormone that, first of all, dampens fear, and it also is the hormone, sometimes it's called the cuddle hormone. It's the hormone that makes us want to connect, that really opens our heart. And when people are experiencing compassion, they also get a little jolt of dopamine, which is energizing. So compassion actually, when we are in a compassionate state, we are primed to connect and primed to act. And I think this is very, very good news. So when we can be compassionate, we can really connect with each other and do everything we can out of compassion to support human dignity as we engage in seeing things clearly and really telling the truth. So here's the ending of Potiphar's story. Here's what happened to her. She entered the nuns' community and became one of the most respected members. Her compassionate care for other women who had suffered great deprivation was legendary. One woman named Conda encountered Potiphar after she had lost her husband and her children and her parents to a plague where they were just all wiped out in a very short time, and she was reduced to begging. Because at that time, in what we now know of India, that northern Gangetic plain, women were totally dependent on the support of a male or a male relative. If they did not have a male relative to protect them and to support them, they were at the mercy of anyone. And as in this case, Kanda had to beg to get any sort of food. Kanda said of Potiphar, she wrote, and these are in a collection of poems by the early nuns, out of pity, she guided me in leaving home. And leaving home was the phrase that was used for someone to become part of the nuns' community or any, the monastic community, it was called leaving home. Out of pity, she guided me in leaving home, encouraged me, and urged me to the highest goal. I took her advice. It wasn't wasted. So she became a fully realized person. Another nun said of Potiphar, I went to see a nun I thought I could trust. Safety is so important to us. Finding people we can trust, finding communities we can trust. So it is such an honorific to say, this is a person I can trust. And that's what the other women felt about Potiphar. She was someone they could trust. And another nun said, she pulled the arrow out of my heart. She pulled the arrow out of my heart. So she became a great being in that early nuns community. She became a really important leader. She became someone who could help people work through and be with the suffering that they had encountered in their lives, and to see things clearly, and to really become fully realized, which means, you know, letting go of all greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what enlightenment is. Uprooting greed, hatred, and illusion. And here are the final verses of Potiphar's own poem about her realization. She said, bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you'd train a good horse. Then I took a lamp, went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. I'll read it again. Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp, went into my cell, checked the bed, sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So I take some inspiration from Padakara's transformation of her extreme suffering and extreme trauma, and the way she was able to become a refuge for other persons. But I also think it's really, really important to look at the Buddha's example of what he did when confronted, I shouldn't say confronted by, because he actually chose to encounter Padakara. He chose to place himself in her path and to see her for who she was. And that's a big part of compassion, is really seeing people for who they are in all their desperation, in all their confusion, in all their foulness, as she was befouled, and to really accept that, and to see the human dignity underneath all of that, and to see the possibility of that individual becoming reconnected to their human dignity. And this is what we can wish for everyone. And this is something I believe that we can strive for in our own efforts to really develop our compassion, to be able to see clearly and speak truthfully. And it really is a way of not letting ourselves succumb to despair. So I would be delighted if people would share their responses, their experiences, or any questions about what this might mean and how to practice it.
My name is Ali, and this is more symbolic probably than anything. Most 4th of July's, I always hang the flag out, and this year I was thinking of hanging it out upside down, because you know, when you hang the flag out upside down, it's mean you're in distress, and I think we are in distress. And so I had planned to do that, but it just sounded too divisive. So I went online, I found this beautiful peace flag, which has a picture of the world and a globe and the dove in the middle, and it says world peace. So I put that up today, and it was kind of one way of me saying, you know, I can be behind this, because flying the flag right now feels real natural and nationalistic, and it feels real supportive of the current administration. I just couldn't stomach that. So that was kind of one response I had. So just wanted to share that. Could you say how you spelled Picard, her name?
Padakara. It's Patacara. And her account is found in Susan Murdoch's book about the first Buddhist nuns, which has recently been reprinted.
It's an excellent story. Thank you so much. Excellent.
It's a very hard story. Hard to imagine more compacted trauma than Padakara experienced.
My name's Kyle. I'm going to share something kind of personal. So today I've really just been swept by fear today. I just have this bad feeling about I just like don't want to be by any crowds today. You know what I mean? Just like with the way things are. And I've just and throughout the beginning of the day, I just you know, it's tough. And it's like every time I entertain the thought, it comes back. You know what I mean? Or like think about 4th of July, or just, I just have this feeling. Mm-hmm. And I've literally just like, I don't know what else to do. I've just been like meditating, praying, like trying to intervene on some behalf. Like I just feel really strongly about it. And I just like any sort of like advice or something like, thank you. Last week I bicycled past this place randomly. I've been practicing meditation by myself for 4 months, and it's really great. And once I found this place, a door started opening. I started meeting other people, and I guess my story, if you don't mind, I'd like to tell a little bit of my story. I have this history of bipolar and schizoaffective. Mm-hmm. It runs in my family, and I feel like the fear today is something to do with that. And like the story, like the spiritual transformation I've had is that I am just ultimately dependent on connecting with something greater than myself. Mm-hmm. I need the relaxation in the centeredness to keep going. And that's all. Thank you. I really appreciate being in community with people.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So one of the things that I would like to really encourage people to do as part of their spiritual practice, and it's certainly a major part of my spiritual practice, is really to develop loving kindness and compassion practices, and to really bring them to ourselves. Self-compassion is so important. Seeing ourselves completely, accepting ourselves completely. One of the meta phrases I use is, may I accept myself completely and with great kindness, just as I am right now. And to really just hold that aspiration, accepting myself completely and with great kindness, just as I am right now. Telling the truth to myself about myself, but that truth is a truth about human dignity. And it's also about our felt need for safety. I mean, when we do loving kindness practice, we often say, may I be safe and protected in all ways. May no inner or outer harm come to me. Or one of the phrases that I use a lot is, may wisdom and compassion protect me. May wisdom and compassion protect me. And just, if you can, nurture that faith in wisdom and in compassion. That really is what really helps us be with how things are. And part of being a wise person is to connect, is to recognize that very, very basic and beautiful, I mean, human capacity for connection, and to do that skillfully. So I would really encourage you to just practice a lot of of self-compassion, and be, you know, it's not a wimpy practice. It's very clear-eyed, and it is really that felt response to one's own suffering, and that very, very wholesome desire to alleviate it. And as your compassion practice develops, if the people at Madison are right, we're getting more oxytocin and more dopamine, where we're actually doing things that physiologically help us. So I would really encourage you to do that. And thank you for being so candid. Mm-hmm. You want to pass the mic?
My name is Mary, and I in a way can. I've had a lot of loss in my life. I've had a lot of trauma in my life, and I'm really strong, like one of the strongest people that I know, and I just in talking about, what has been going on in our country over the last year and a half. I'm the kind of person that I'm aware of my strength and my privilege. And I, even if it's small steps, I try to do things that will contribute to the collective making a difference, even if it's something small. And it's just so exhausting, when it's one thing after another, it's just so exhausting. And I think this is where the despair comes in. So I really appreciate your talk tonight. It was really helpful. And I just wanted to let you guys know that if you're interested in taking some action or looking for a group who is supporting immigrants' rights, mm-hmm. I actually have started going to the meetings of a group called MIRAC, Minnesota Immigrants' Rights Action mm-hmm. Committee, and they've really got their act together. I marched with them during the march. There's a couple of immigration lawyers mm-hmm. that are really involved mm-hmm. in it, mm-hmm. and really, really got it together. You can probably find them on Facebook if you wanted to get involved.
Say the name again.
MIRAC.
M-I-R. Spell the acronym.
MIRAC. Their Twitter handle is MIRAC MN, MIRAC okay. Minnesota. And it's Minnesota Immigrants Rights Action Committee. And I think they have meetings every Thursday. So I just wanted to put that out there, because I sometimes I just feel so helpless, like mm-hmm. I want to do something, and so I started going. I went to their meeting and I marched with them, and it's just a little thing, but it's something, and I feel like I'm doing something.
Thank you.
Like it's not so out of control.
You've reminded me when you talked about exhaustion. It was my great good fortune this past spring to do Ruth King's mindfulness of race training twice, once with the Common Ground community and then with a smaller cohort of people. It's called the Community Dharma Leaders cohort, and to do that with a much smaller intimate group in Massachusetts. And one of the things that Ruth insists on and makes part of all of her training around working with race is to really nurture whatever creative part we have in ourselves, to sort of balance out all the heaviness with some joy. And you can think about some of the songs that came out of the civil rights movement. You can think about how often people found ways to express an appreciation of beauty. Bo Lozoff, who was the guy who did so much to get meditation into correctional facilities, used to say, there are two things that human beings have always done together. They've sat in silence and they've sung together. And so, you know, that sort of connecting through exuberant dancing, through singing, through playing instruments, through, you know, when you read the poems of Mary Oliver, for example, you think, okay, here is someone else who really values paying attention. It's to really understand the importance of nourishing ourselves when we are encountering circumstances that are really depleting, that it is really important to take care of ourselves in that way. And it's not just kind of therapeutically taking care of ourselves. No, when we engage with creativity and we engage with beauty and we engage in, you know, the beauty of each other, that's when we really get inspired. I mean, really good ideas come out of that. It's not just that we're sort of taking a nap for a minute before we get back to work. We're really doing something that really is strengthening in so many, so many ways. So to really, as we're, you know, so many people just say, I can't do that. And I think, okay, but put on some really good music then. Put on the songs that inspire you. You know, it's not about, you know, ducking and hide. It's really about how do we engage compassionately in a way that is really effective. And I think it really helps to take the long view. There is this wonderful monk who lived in Sri Lanka, and I'm blanking on his name. It's SS are his names, first and last monastic names. But he said that he had this vision of Sri Lanka as, it would be a place that would teach people how to live in a democracy. And of course, as we all know, like, Sri Lanka has had incredible civil war, and even now there is Buddhist Tamil conflict. And when he was asked about this, he said, my plan is a 500-year plan. Now, that may seem absurd to us, because what we want to do is to be effective now. But I think it's also really important not to also take the long view. I mean, we can never know how words that are spoken in one century will resonate in another, how actions taken in one century or one decade will inspire people in another. We just don't know. So the idea is what we know is that compassion is effective, that compassion is a good, that compassion is part of being, part of our human dignity, part of our lives as people living with human dignity. So that's what we can really strengthen, not knowing what the immediate outcome is, but knowing that we're contributing in the long run to the good. Anything else that people would like to say? Yeah, let's go to the back first. With I was going to give you the shulon, but you'd probably like the mic instead. And then Don. So Jalan and then Don. Okay.
Hi, I'm Jalan. Patrice, I just want to say, like, well done. Every time Mark goes on retreat somewhere, I'm like, oh, do I go? I don't know who's doing it tonight. Oh, I hope it's good. It's not Mark. Oh. And, like, I've not heard you give a Dharma talk before, and I'm just, like, I'm floored. Like, that was amazing. I'm very, very touched and appreciative. It was on point and organized, and really speaks to where my heart is right now. And I also want to say how much I appreciate you sharing your compassion phrases, because those also very much resonated with me. And so I just am so happy you're here. I have so much gratitude. And so a lot of wisdom. Thank you.
I'm Don, and I wanted to say the same thing. It was very inspiring, because I think I've been despairing as well. So thank you for all of the story. And it just, oh, there's just a lot to think about on this. It was just so wonderful that the Buddha was able to see that she was suffering, and then being able to just kind of get in that path. And so I think maybe that's, I can relate to that. I feel like I've been suffering but not really knowing. So I've been going around in circles. And it was nice. This gets kind of in my face. There is suffering. Things pass, and that we're all connected. That is really something that I really want to kind of contemplate. And yeah, very inspiring, and I think that's all I have for right now. Thanks.
Oh, Tammy?
Well, first, Patrice, I've heard you give many Dharma talks, and that was very good. Thank you for the teaching. What has come up for me is, you know, in some of what you brought up has me thinking about feeling into the despair that we feel as a people, as a nation. And, you know, personally, I think that it's a very good thing that, like, the consciousness of the nation is pricked at this point, and that there's this shaking and awakening. I think that so much of the discomfort we feel has great healing potential if we allow it to. And one of the things that comes up for me in this is, you know, you touched on the importance of handling ourselves with both wisdom and compassion. And I really appreciate that, because I think it's easy, especially in mindfulness communities, to focus in on the wisdom. The wisdom's important, you know. But the Buddha broke the teachings up into two wings, the wisdom and the compassion teachings. And I think particularly when things are really hard, and I just came out of the last couple of weeks of really intense professional life, and like that's, and I was doing a lot of wisdom practice, and I was wondering why I was getting more and more stressed out. I remember having a conversation with Mark about it, and he's like, well, have you, how much compassion practice are you practicing right now? And I switched my practice over some, and that really helped me to feed the heart, to warm the heart, to fuel the heart. And so that's one thing that I appreciate you bringing up. I think that it's so important. Like, you know, Ruth talks about it, everybody talks about it, but I think like making that a practice, an embodied practice, is important. Then the other thing that comes up is that at times when I have these conversations with friends, and there's like this, and there's the idea of getting stuck in despair, I actually think that it's an exercise of privilege to allow ourselves to get stuck in the despair. And it's a privilege that many people, not the least of which are in cages along our southern border, can't afford for us to exercise at this point. And I think that the self-care that I need to do is more than just something that I do because it makes me feel that, but it's as a responsibility both to myself and to the others in this world. Like, it's a deep responsibility that I care for myself and that I do this work, because if I'm stuck, then there's no space, there's no room. You know, when Pratikara was walking around without her state of mind, there was no room for her to be a nun and to be of service to other people. When she regained her state of mind, she did her work, and the room, the space, the equanimity, the balance, the expanse was there. And so I often, that comes up for me at times in circles like this, because sometimes like the despair can be seen. The despair is real, but like I think that the despair, like, and it's not to say don't feel the pain. Like, I feel like it's important to feel the pain, like to process that. And when, and as I process these things, it's important for me to do that work and to feel it through my body, and to not let it get stuck at the discomfort or the sadness or the space that allows me to just hit the eject button and hop on Facebook, but to really stay committed to the work down to the bitter dregs of it all, and let that process have its way with me. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Femi, for that. I'm Nancy. I guess, well, thank you so much. The story was really beautiful for me because it really hit home. 10 years ago, right about now, I was going through a really horrible divorce, and I was really in a lot of despair, and my kids were tiny, and they were in a lot of pain, and that was the worst part of it, is that my kids were suffering. And I didn't see any way out of it, and I just felt really trapped. And I had a friend who was really a kind of an angel. She had just come into my life and was trying to just listen to me and be there for me. And she brought me to Mark's house when it was back at, when Common Ground was in Mark and Wynn's living room. And I really didn't even know what I was going to. She just brought me there, and I sat through a program. And then afterwards, I went up and met Mark. And I just started like kind of ranting like my story to him, and just kind of like unloading as I was doing, because I was in so much trauma. And I just, that's just kind of what I was doing at that point. Like, I couldn't hold back my story. And he was like the first person I met that didn't react in fear to me. Like, he was just kind of like not afraid of me. And that struck me. I was like, it kind of woke me up, because he just was like a completely different, he had a totally different reaction to me than any other human. And he said, I think he said something like, you're not going to find the answer in your story or in your mind. It's not there. He just said something really simple but really clear. And I just dropped my story at that point. And I knew he was right, that there wasn't any, I couldn't find it in my mind. Like, I couldn't find the answer I was looking for. Like, I was on this treadmill walking in the circles. And it was just such a powerful moment. I was like, oh my gosh, he's right. It's not there. And that's so awesome. Mm-hmm. I can't find it in my head. And so I can just stop looking, and I can just be. And the freedom is in this moment. And it was just like so powerful. And it's so wonderful to come back to that. Like, I'd forgotten my story until tonight, until you mm-hmm. told that story. And I was like, that's me. Like, that was my story. And Mark was Buddha for in that mm-hmm. moment for me. And he, and then I just kept meditating. I mean, then here I am 10 years later, still, you know, plodding along. And then, so thank you, Mark, and all of you. And the other thing is just, I really appreciate what you said, Femi, about it being a privilege to be in despair, because I think that that's really true. And I feel like, I really like what you said about compassion being connecting. And then how it starts with yourself, and you really have to, like, I need to start there, but then I do need to keep moving out to the connecting part, because I feel like I stop a lot with myself, and I can have compassion for myself, but then I don't always let it move me to action. Mm-hmm. And I feel really challenged to do more after coming tonight, so thank you.
One more? The back? Sure.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, it's been great to hear all your words, and thanks for the excellent talk. I was messaging my partner this morning. She's down in Florida on travel for business, and she was kind of despairing, like, you know, 4th of July is like very, you know, triggering for me. just because of our country's history of oppression. And I suggest that, you know, why don't we, how about we make this day just like any other, you know, weekend, you know, where you just sort of celebrate some time off, some taking some time for yourself and, you know, find some support in other people. So I want to thank you all for helping me, you know, get that. It's been great. Really appreciate it. I also wanted to ask a question. So sometimes when I do like a compassion meditation, it feels like I'm lifting a super heavy weight. Like I'm just sort of hardened to, these sort of deep feelings of compassion sometimes. So I'm wondering like, how can I work with that when I sort of feel kind of an obstacle come up in that practice?
So let me make sure that I understand you correctly. So is it that the compassion that what you're working with is so heavy that you feel immobilized?
It's kind of like, you know, when you see, maybe you've had the experience of seeing something really unpleasant, you know, something that happened to somebody else or an unpleasant news headline, and you just kind of think, this happens all the time, you know. There are plenty of other headlines like this. Why should this be? I guess I'm just like hardened to it sometimes. But I also feel this sort of adverse effect of, you know, having those sort of defenses and blocking it out of my mind. So I'm wondering, like, how can you sort of... But I feel like letting stuff sort of into my mind and letting myself feel that compassion is very difficult right now. How can I work on that?
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. So one thing is that, I mean, we've all heard about compassion fatigue when people are just feeling so overwhelmed by what's happening. But there's also, the idea is that the Buddha told the truth about this, and you hear something terrible, and you say, and things like that happen all the time. And the Buddha would say, and that's true. Things like that happen all the time. And what I find really important is not to find a way not to minimize, not to exaggerate, to just really try to be clear. And sometimes, if it's something like child trafficking, you could make an effort to learn more about it so that you don't just feel, oh, here's this information and I'm overwhelmed. You could always choose to learn more about something so that when you just see those headlines, you have a clearer felt response of what this is about. But the other part, when we're feeling kind of overwhelmed by all the bad news, is to really make an effort to look for the good. I mean, this afternoon I saw Won't You Be My Neighbor, the new documentary about Fred Rogers. And it was just, he was really clear that he thought children's feelings ought to be respected. And he was really clear that he thought children were harmed and demeaned by a lot of the images that were portrayed in television. And it was so, he was so committed to his kindness. And people did talk about how, you know, when he did a little Daniel the Tiger puppet, that actually when he had Daniel expressing feelings, those were the feelings that he could not express himself. And he sort of admits that. So, I mean, but it was very inspiring to hear about someone who really had a commitment to helping children, to helping children feel their inherent worth. And watch the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary a few weeks ago, and to see how she inspired people. So I think as we are bombarded with bad news or things that are really undermining. Maybe undermining is the right word. We should try to actively find things that encourage us. Look for stories of generosity, of kindness, because they're out there. And they're often close by, too. One of the things that Mr. Rogers asked people to do was, he said, and he did this at a commencement ceremony, he said, take a full minute just to think about someone who has supported you in your life. So in loving kindness practice, we often reflect on the benefactor, someone who supported us. So sometimes doing something like that, bringing to mind the people in our lives who have been sources of goodness and care and inspiration, maybe thinking even of people we don't personally know but admire. For example, the Dalai Lama often comes to mind, Thich Nhat Hanh. There are just other, so really making an effort, because it sounds like you sort of feel overwhelmed and undermined, and when we are that way, the natural response is just to sort of push it away. But instead, to really connect with the stories of people doing good and how that has made a difference, and how at the beginning it wasn't seen what a difference that would make. And so to really be heartened by that. So it's just after 9, so we need to close. Did you have any announcements you need to make, Kevin? Yes.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.